Today is Monday, December the 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin are scheduled to speak via video call on Tuesday as tensions between the U.S. and Russia escalate over Ukraine. And former Senate leader and Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole of Kansas has died at the age of 98.
We already have begun to unite our party. Soon we will rally our nation. And nothing will stand in our way when we rally the nation and bring the voters out on November 5, 1996.
That was former Senator Bob Dole campaigning in New Hampshire in March of 1996. Senator Dole later conceded to his opponent, President Bill Clinton, after his loss. And Gambia's President Adama Barrow has won re-election in a highly contested race.
Adama Barrow, NPP, 7,489. UDP, 995.
Gambia's Electoral Commission Chairman. And women activists in Kabul are calling for more change, claiming that the new Taliban decree banning forced marriage isn't enough to address the issue of women's rights. We have this story and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, former Senate leader and Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole of Kansas has died at the age of 98. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Known for strong leadership and quick wit, Bob Dole served in the Senate from 1969 to 1996, and he left to run against incumbent President Bill Clinton after losing.
I thought I was a pretty good person, and our slogan was a better man for a better America.
Dole overcame disabling World War II injuries and chaired the World War II Memorial Campaign.
Without the World War II guys that are here today and others like them, I don't know where we'd be.
He always had a pen in his damaged right hand to avoid embarrassing someone who reached out for a handshake. In early 2018, he received the Congressional Gold Medal.
I want to thank all those who have said such kind words about me. They're probably not true, but they were nice.
Robert Joseph Dole, married in 1948, had a daughter and then divorced, marrying his second wife, Elizabeth, in 1975. I'm Jackie Quinn.
U.S. intelligence finds Russia is planning a Ukraine offensive. AP correspondent Mike Garcia has more.
U.S. intelligence officials have determined Russia is planning for a possible military offensive against Ukraine as soon as early 2022. An administration official who spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity said U.S. intelligence estimates the Russian offensive would include an estimated 175,000 personnel. Moscow is pressing Washington for assurances that Ukraine will not be allowed to join the NATO alliance. Addressing the Russian threat Friday, Biden said he's working on what he termed a meaningful set of initiatives
to make it very, very difficult for Mr. Putin to go ahead and do what people are worried he may do.
Biden could have calls next week with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Mike Garcia, Washington.
And President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin are scheduled to speak via video call on Tuesday as tensions between the U.S. and Russia escalate over Ukraine. AP correspondent Naomi Shannon reports.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov confirms the two leaders will talk on Tuesday evening as tensions between America and Russia escalate over a Russian troop buildup on the Ukrainian border, seen as a sign of potential invasion. Russia is more adamant than ever that the U.S. doesn't admit Ukraine to the NATO military alliance. However, according to an anonymous Biden administration official, about 70,000 Russian troops are said to be at the Ukrainian border already, and an invasion is possible as soon as early next year. I'm Naomi Shannon.
U.S. President Joe Biden will host a virtual summit for democracy later this week, which will bring together world leaders, civil society, and the private sector to counter authoritarianism, fight corruption, and promote respect for human rights. The summit comes amid democratic backsliding in many parts of the world and questions of the U.S.'s own democratic standing. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakuswara has this preview.
A military takeover in Myanmar, an attack on Brazil's election system by its own president, the assassination of the Haitian president and several coups on the African continent. These are just some of the democratic declines the world has witnessed in 2021, the backdrop of an upcoming virtual gathering hosted by U.S. President Joe Biden on December 9th and 10th called the Summit for Democracy. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
This is an opportunity for leaders to discuss the challenges and opportunities facing democratic governments and how democracies can deliver for their citizens based on the summit pillars of strengthening democracy, defending against authoritarianism, fighting corruption, and promoting respect for human rights.
The summit is part of Biden's campaign pledge to strengthen democracy around the world and will be attended by 110 countries. Christopher Walker is Vice President for Studies and Analysis at the National Endowment for Democracy.
The mobilization and the awareness raising and the focusing of the collective mind on these important democracy issues has already been a very salutary step taken by the administration.
Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin are not invited. While the summit is not explicitly about rallying the world against Russia or China, it is an opportunity for Biden to mobilize support against what he sees as their increasing authoritarian influence, said Stacey Goddard, the Mildred Lane Kemper Professor of Political Science at Wellesley College.
Bringing together democracies is in many ways a strategy that's designed to draw a line between the United States and its allies and Russia and China, and really to try to call on those states to choose a little bit. Not surprisingly, it makes them uncomfortable. States like South Korea, states like Germany, they really do depend on China for their economic prosperity.
Chinese Vice Foreign Minister Liu Yuchong said the summit will hurt global solidarity.
It divides countries into different levels of hierarchy, labels them as democratic or undemocratic, and point fingers at other countries' democratic systems.
During the summit, leaders will be encouraged to announce various commitments to strengthen democracy, but it's unclear whether these will turn into action. Still, the signaling of American democratic values is significant, said Stephen Feldstein, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
It shows a pretty significant break from the Trump administration, so that's important. And I think the kind of subsequent year of action that the Biden administration has announced will be really a really proof of concept.
Some have also questioned whether the U.S. has moral standing to host a summit, following the January 6th siege of the Capitol by supporters of Donald Trump seeking to overturn the former president's electoral defeat. The Biden administration says it is precisely the ability to acknowledge imperfections and confront them transparently, a strength unique to democracies, that the summit is meant to showcase. Patsy Vida-Kuswara, VOA News at the White House.
The White House is lit with holiday cheer for this year's festive season, with the First Lady Jill Biden's Christmas deco theme of Gifts from the Heart. VOA's Anita Paul has more from the White House.
For her first Christmas as First Lady, Jill Biden chose Gifts from the Heart as her theme, and she's filled the White House with tributes to those who have inspired her in the past year. Frontline workers who soldiered through the pandemic, service members who gave their lives, and members of her family and those of previous presidents. First Lady Jill Biden.
For all of our differences, we are united by what really matters. Like points on a star, we come together at the heart. That is what I wanted to reflect in our White House this year. In each room, we tell a story of gifts from the heart. In the East Wing, we see the gift of service with shooting stars representing the frontline workers who brought light to our lives in the darkest days of this pandemic.
This year's decorations echo the theme of the last Christmas of previous First Lady Melania Trump. Trump's final Christmas decorations as First Lady paid tribute to first responders. As usual, the White House pastry team this year spent several weeks putting together a hefty gingerbread display. This year, it includes a school, police, fire, and gas stations, a hospital, a post office, a grocery store, and a warehouse. Executive pastry chef Susan Morrison.
It's all made of gingerbread, royal icing, chocolate, some gum paste, too.
So I promise I'm not going to do this. Could you eat all of this?
You could technically, but it's meant for display. So the icing on the outside, when it's exposed to air, becomes very firm like concrete.
Christmas trees have been a White House fixture for more than a century, but it was First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy who started decorating by theme. The First Lady's efforts haven't always been warmly received. Critics howled over former First Lady Melania Trump's 2018 decorations, which included red Christmas trees, with some calling them more frightening than festive. But the First Lady said that while the world may still be scary, the holidays shouldn't be.
No matter how dark the night, when we turn toward that light, we will never be lost. So thank you for helping us share those gifts from the heart. And happy holidays and Merry Christmas from our family to all of yours. We love you. Thank you.
As usual, the White House went big. More than 100 volunteers festooned 41 Christmas trees with 80,000 lights, 6,000 feet of ribbon, and more than 10,000 ornaments. Anita Pell, VOA News, at the White House.
The U.S. Air Force says that more than 6% of its Air National Guard and Reserve forces failed to meet a deadline for getting a coronavirus vaccine. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn joins us again with this report.
The Air Force says more than 6% of the Air National Guard and Reserve forces failed to meet a deadline for getting a coronavirus vaccine. The Air Force says roughly 11,000 of its Guard and Reserve personnel haven't gotten the shots, nor a medical exemption as required. They'll be allowed to participate in an upcoming monthly drill and still get paid. But Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin made it clear the vaccine's mandatory for the nation's Guard troops. A memo last week said those who refuse the mandatory COVID vaccination will be barred from federally funded drills and refuse the training they need to maintain their Guard status. He's giving the military services a little more time to publish their official guidance on how to deal with Guard members who refuse the vaccine. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Women activists in Kabul are calling for more change, claiming that the new Taliban decree banning forced marriage isn't enough to address the issue of women's rights. AP correspondent Naomi Shannon reports.
Despite a new Taliban mandate which makes forced marriage illegal, women activists in the Afghan capital believe this is not enough to address the issues of women's rights and are insisting that they would continue fighting for their right to education, employment, and participation in political and social life. Since the Taliban takeover in mid-August, education at the secondary school level and above has been banned. The new decree is seen as a strategic move to encourage international recognition of their government and restore aid to the country. I'm Naomi Shannon.
Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music.
Wake up, dance this music.
Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. And in The Gambia, incumbent President Adama Barrow has been declared winner of this weekend's highly contested elections. The country's Electoral Commission says President Barrow had received around 53% of the vote, beating his nearest rival, political veteran Usaini Dabo. Thousands of Gambians stand up to vote in the first democratic election since former President Yahya Jammeh was voted out of office in 2016. Jammeh was forced into exile in Equatorial Guinea after refusing to accept defeat to Barrow. Sene Marena is a Gambian political analyst and founding editor of the Gambian focused online news magazine, Alkamba Times. He tells me that, aside from Barrow benefiting from the power of the incumbency, he also had been able to win over a coalition of other smaller political parties.
President Barrow, a few hours ago, was declared the president of the Republic of the Gambia after a landslide victory, you know, defeating his political opponent, the leader of the United Democratic Party, lawyer Usainu Darboe, a guy he called his political godfather. Barrow won with a margin of 53.2%, you know, while Usainu Darboe 27.7% with a total number of 238,253 votes for Usainu Darboe, while Barrow pulled massively with 457,519 votes.
So, Sene, what are some of the other major parties that were contesting in these elections, and what are they saying about the election process and the results?
The main challenger to President Barrow is his political godfather, lawyer Usainu Darboe from the opposition United Democratic Party, who pulled second to Mr. Barrow. Moments before the IEC, that's the electoral body, concludes the announcement of the result, they gather at lawyer Darboe's residence in Banjul to reject the votes, claiming that there were some errors and fraud in the counting process. So as we speak, three opposition candidates, including lawyer Usainu Darboe, independent candidate Esambai Fall, who was the former lead counsel at the Truth Commission, and Mama Kande, who came third in 2016 presidential election, a former Jammeh lawmaker. So three men gathered at Mr. Darboe's residence to reject the preliminary result of the election. So as we speak, they are rejecting the result.
Now, what kind of message did President Barrow run on this time around? And how did the power of incumbency help him in this race?
The power of incumbency helped Mr. Barrow to win landslide in this election. Barrow came to power in 2016. With the backing of seven coalition partners, including Mr. Darboe's party. But after 2 years into power, they fell out. He sacked Mr. Darboe as his vice president, leading to Barrow forming his own political party called the National People Party in 2019. Since then, there were some coalition members that endorsed him who stayed with him during this process. So after Barrow is going... Barrow challenged the other candidate with 17 other political parties, including the other coalition parties that endorsed him during the 2016 presidential election. So Barrow has a backing of over 17 political parties, including independent candidates whose nominations were rejected by the Electoral Commission in November.
That was Sene Marena, a Gambian political analyst and founding editor of the Gambian-focused online news magazine, Alkamba Times. He joined me by phone from Seattle, Washington. And in other news, Myanmar's junta chief sat down with a prominent senior figure of Aung San Suu Kyi's ousted party on Sunday, the first significant meeting since the February coup. The military deposed Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy party from power, pushing many of her closest political allies into hiding, while others have been arrested. The junta alleged electoral fraud in last year's poll as a justification for the push, but much of the country is in open revolt, calling for a return to democracy. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just search for VOA Africa. Astronomers from the University of Texas at Austin have discovered a massive black hole at the center of one of the Milky Way's satellite galaxies. Rick Pantaleo has more with today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
There are said to be dozens of smaller so-called satellite galaxies that surround and are gravitationally bound to the Milky Way. A number of these galaxies are considered dwarf galaxies. Unlike the Milky Way with its estimated 100,000 million stars, dwarf galaxies are much smaller and can contain up to several billion stars. A team of astronomers at the University of Texas Austin says in a new paper that they have found an enormous black hole at the center of a dwarf galaxy called Leo 1. At the heart of the Milky Way, scientists say there is a supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A star. The Texan astronomers say they have found evidence that Leo 1's black hole is almost as massive as the one in our galaxy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The UN Refugee Agency has expressed outrage at the sharp rise in deadly attacks by armed groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri and South Kivu provinces. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Dozens of people have been killed and scores wounded in the last month in the series of raids on sites harboring displaced people. The latest incident took place Sunday at Njala, a site for displaced people in the Drodro health zone in Ituri province. Local authorities say 10 women and 9 children were killed and 11 people wounded. They say men used guns, machetes, and knives during their killing spree. A spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, Boris Cheshakov, says the attack was preceded by a series of grisly assaults against unarmed civilians who were displaced by previous atrocities.
And what we have seen just in the span of several weeks is an increase in the number and frequency of attacks. And these are brutal attacks. At the end of these attacks, we have the bodies of women, of children, of families, and whole communities are torn apart.
About 120 armed groups reportedly operate in eastern DRC. Media reports put the blame for the recent attacks on fighters from the Cooperative for the Development of the Congo, known as CODECO. The group is composed mainly of people from the Lendu farming community. Decades of intercommunal ethnic conflicts between Lendu agriculturalists and Hema pastoralists have resulted in tens of thousands of deaths. Cheshirkov says the recent clashes have uprooted thousands of people living in locations that are housing displaced people. For example, he notes a deadly attack on November 21st in villages in Drodro and Che forced some 20,000 inhabitants to flee for safety to Ro, a site near a UN military base.
The site doubled in size from 21,000 to 40,500 people in just 48 hours. Forcing the newly arrived families to sleep in the open. The main needs are food, shelter, and healthcare, as well as psychosocial assistance.
The UNHCR is calling on all parties to stop the attacks on displaced communities and to treat those facilities as sanctuaries for people who are forced to flee their homes. The agency is appealing for greater financial support, adding it has received only 52% of the $205 million needed for its life-saving operation in the DRC. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
International Edition continues. World health experts are still searching for the origins of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. But in Botswana, where the variant was first reported, officials say that what matters is that it was discovered, not where it came from. From Habarone, Kondisi Dube reports.
Amid questions over the origins of Omicron, a new and highly transmittable variant of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, Botswana says the focus should be on finding solutions to the pandemic. Botswana and South Africa were the first to report the new variant, which is said to be highly contagious and has spread around the globe. Initially, Omicron was thought to have originated from Botswana, but the Southern African country was quick to dismiss the reports. President Mokgweetsi Masisi, in an interview with CNN Thursday, said the variant was detected in diplomats who visited Botswana but had passed through Europe.
The diplomats came from a number of countries, the countries of origin, the countries of workstation, and they passed through a number of countries to get to Botswana. And yes, some had been to Europe, and some had been elsewhere. It would seem the very creation of this new virus is as a result of interventions from a diversity of sources.
But some scientists, including South African-based Richard Lessels, who was part of the team that discovered the new variant, say it is key to tracing the origins of the variant. They argue one key way out of a variant puzzle is to trace genetic origins, which is why it matters to know where Omicron originated. Trevor Bedford, a computational virologist and professor at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in the U.S. city of Seattle, is also involved in researching Omicron's origins. He told U.S.-based National Public Radio that identifying the source of the virus would help scientists assess the potential threat of the variant through making educated guesses. For instance, he says if Omicron had been evolving out of sight in a large population of humans over a period of months, it suggests that the variant is less transmissible. But Botswana Minister of Health Edwin Dikolodi says tracing the variant's origins will only stigmatize the country where it is traced.
Where the virus originates from is not important. We are not going to be geopoliticizing this virus. What is important is to applaud our scientists who have discovered or found this virus to make the world aware of it so that we can act quicker to reduce the transmission.
Dikolodi says Botswana will not disclose the nationalities of the four diplomats in their countries of origin. President Masisi says Botswana and South Africa are paying the price for the discovery of Omicron after other countries placed travel bans on several African countries following the announcement. Instead, he says the scientists who discovered and reported the variant should be celebrated.
I'd like to applaud our scientific community for their relentless efforts in monitoring the variant and being the first to sequence the Omicron variant of concern and making information available to the international community timelessly, as is their responsibility. The response by some countries to our detection of the Omicron variant is unfortunate, as it appears to have caused unnecessary panic amongst the public across the world.
President Masisi describes the ban on mostly visitors from Southern Africa as divisive.
Even if they didn't originate in Europe, I make no sense of these travel bans. These travel bans, if I were to be more candid, are nothing but a manifestation of neo-imperialist thinking. These travel bans, if I can be very direct, are very paternalizing and very divisive, and they undermine our belief systems in multilateralism. They question our confidence in proclaimed addiction to principles of human rights.
While the new variant is said to be highly infectious, in Botswana, with a population of about 2.4 million people, the infection rate has been rather slow, with only 24 reported cases, all of them with mild symptoms. While Botswana maintains it is not important to report the place of discovery of the Omicron variant, scientists like Bedford and Lessels argue it is critical to find out where it came from in order to help fight it. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
Somalia's annual Mogadishu International Book Fair has resumed following the suspension of the event last year due to the coronavirus pandemic. Restrictions were applied to the invitation-only event this year in order to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Mohamed Kahia reports from the capital, Mogadishu.
This year's book fair was limited to a few people, especially authors, due to the coronavirus pandemic. But according to the founder of the fair, Mohamed Dini, organizers are already working to accommodate more people next year.
So in essence, we really are doing about 10% of what we did. And ultimately, we just wanted to do something, even if it's little, so that next year we can go back to our previous state, inshallah.
Selected students from Mogadishu schools were invited this year to the Children's Corner, where they enjoyed reading, storytelling, and cultural tales. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.